So we open the Parsha of Kisetze, which is packed with mitzvahs. And one of the sections in the beginning of the Parsha is a well-known concept, much to speak about, and that is the idea of Ben Sora Umore. And that is in Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Yud Ches. Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Yud Ches. And the Pasuk reads, Ki Yele Ish Bein Sorer Umorer. If one should have a son who is, as he's referred to, the wayward son, Einenu Shemer B'Kol Aviv V'Kol Imo, doesn't listen not to his mother, not to his father. I think nowadays one would need perhaps more defining characteristics in order to create a subcategory of children. V'yisru also, and they chastise him v'lo yishma aleihem. And as we know, and as the pasuk describes, and the Gemara elaborates, this is someone, not only does he not listen to his father and his mother, he steals from them, he develops very expensive habits, he's fond of good meat, fine wine, those things cost money, and when the money runs out, so then he will do what it takes in order to finance his habits. And that is why they take him to the Beis Din, and Pasuk Kaf Aleph says, Urugamuhu kol anshei yiro b'avanim v'meis, and he needs to be stoned, uviyar tahara mikirbecha, so that evil will be removed from your midst, v'chol Yisrael yishmu'u v'yiro. And everyone needs to know about this, everyone should see, everyone should hear and see. So this is the well-known section, the well-known idea of the Ben Sora Umore. And there is also an accompanying well-known comment in the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Aleph Amud Aleph, which states that there was never really a case of Ben Sora Umore. It never actually happened. And the background to this, as you go through the halachas, there's so many escape clauses almost, so many technicalities upon which he could be let off. It's practically impossible that it would ever happen, and lemaisa, it never did happen. Lo haya, and moreover, says the Gemara, v'lo yiyah, and there never will be a case of Ben Sora Umore. So if that's the case, so then why does the Torah talk about it? Something that will never happen. So why does the Torah discuss it? Drosh v'kabel sachar, expound upon it, and you will receive reward. And as we can appreciate, that reason also needs inspection. Why does the Torah write something that will never happen? So that you can expound on it and receive reward. Reward for what? For expounding on Divrei Torah. But aren't there 612 other mitzvahs which could apply? And you could expound on them and receive equal reward. So it sounds like this is Torah Lishma. It is purely there for the Torah. But what is not so well known is that immediately, having expressed this idea that there never was and never will be a case of Ben Sora Umore, Rabbi Yonason chimes in the Gemara. And Rabbi Yonason says, no, that's not so. There was a case, at least one, Ani Ra'isi, I saw a case of Ben Sora Umore, Yoshavti al Kivro, I sat next to his grave. So, there you go. The Gemara says, never such a thing. Rabbi Yonason says, yes, there was. I was there, and I saw his grave. So this is a bit of a difficult machlokas. I mean, normally the machlokasim that we're, I would say, more comfortable with, to use a delicate expression, are matters of law. Should he be exempt? Should he be liable? Should it be Tommy? Should it be Tahor? It's difficult to know how to relate to a machlokas and hilchos. Did something happen? And one opinion says it didn't happen, and one says it did happen, and where's the machlokas? It's especially interesting that as the pasuk that we read, when the ben sora umera, or if it happens, it's meant to be publicized. The final words of the section are v'chol Yisrael yishbu v'yiro. Everyone needs to hear about it, which is interesting because apparently no one did, except for Rabbi Yonah's son. He's the only person who ever heard about it. I mean, that's a very targeted publicity. It was just to one person. So what are we to make of this machlokas? Now, interestingly, Rabbeinu Bachya, in his Perush on the Torah, he has a comment about this machlokas. He comes seemingly to help matters, but until we understand his words, it's actually going to make things worse. Rabbeinu Bachya says, if you've seen the Gemara and you've seen what one person says in the Gemara, there was never a case of Ben Sora Umura. And then Rabbi Yonasan says that there was a case of Ben Sora Umura. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, you need to know that there is no machlokas here. There is no dispute. And that's the comment of Rabbeinu Bachya. Now, of course, if only it were that simple. Because as disputes go, it looks like a dispute and sounds like a dispute. So what has to happen in order for us to think that it is a machlokas? I mean, how would you define a machlokas? Two people say contrary things. That's the Balabatish definition of a machlokas. And here one says it never happened, and here one says it did happen. What more are we expecting before we say, oh, they seem to be disputing each other? So Rabbeinu Bachya's comments themselves need to be understood. How can you approach a machlokas and just say there's no machlokas and then everything is resolved? And the Chasam Sofer comes in to explain the words of Rabbeinu Bachya. As we noted, the Torah provides many ways for the Ben Sora Umorer punishment not to take place. At the very least, the Gemara says that if his father and mother forgive him, so he doesn't get punished. He doesn't get executed by the Beis Din, which means it will only happen if his parents insist that it happen. And need we add, with parents like that, little wonder that he is the way that he is. But there's so many other things. Their voices need to be identical, and so on and so forth. The Torah is clearly going out of its way, so to speak, to ensure this will never happen. Why? Because when we think of the Ben Sora Umura, I'm not sure how we picture him time-wise. When we conjure up images of wayward and delinquent youths, we put them perhaps more in their late teens, where there's some type of, but this is really, he's just post bar mitzvah. That's young. And the Torah is not going to require that the Beis Din actually kill him. So what does the Torah require? Take note of him. Because there is a worry. And although the official response is, so kill him now so that it never happens, but if that response is never meted out, so keep an eye on him to make sure that what we're worried about will actually never happen. What is the fear? As we said before, he has expensive habits, addictive habits. He starts with his parents, but parents' resources are finite. And therefore, as the Gemara describes, there is every expectation that when the time comes and money at home runs out, he will do what needs to be done, stop at nothing in order to finance his crime. And by the way, here is the Gemara talking about mead and wine, but it's not restricted to that. Rav Moshe Feinstein in his time was asked with regards to the use of drugs. And, of course, as everything else, it needs to be brought under the lens of halacha. Is it asur? Is it mutter? Clearly it's illegal, but what does the Torah say about it? So aside from the damage that it does to a person, says Moshe Feinstein, it seems clear that the Torah's injunction against a ben sora umorer would apply to this entirely. And in fact, experience shows, and as we know, there's all too many cases of people who follow the trail that the Torah describes will happen to the Ben Sora Umura. They need money, they can't do without, and they'll stop at nothing, including robbery and even bloodshed. And the Torah says that's what will happen. And that, says the Chasam Sofer, is what Rabbeinu Bachya means when he says there's no machlokas, as if to say, what are the opinions officially? The first opinion in the Gemara says there was never a case of Ben Sora Umura. Says Rabbi Yonasan, I sat on the grave of a Ben Sora Umura. So did it happen? Did it not happen? Says Rabbi Nubachia, they're both true. Because when the first opinion says it never happened, that means Bezdin never killed a 13-year-old boy as the Torah mandates, because there's so many ways that it will never happen. And therefore, he was never killed in Bezdin. But then Rabbi Yonasan comes and says, so then there's Ben Sora Umura is walking around. I mean, they don't disappear. They don't just develop good behavior just because the Torah has made these technicalities. If the Bezdin doesn't kill them, so they grow up to be what we fear that they will become. Which means in the end they'll be killed, but they'll be killed in an alleyway. Or in some other place. Because they crossed the wrong person and things caught up with them. And that's what Rabbi Yonasan comes to say. Don't think the Ben Sora Umuras go away. If the Bezdin doesn't get them, someone else will get them. If the Bezdin don't mete out justice, someone else will mete out his own version of justice in a much less formal capacity. So when Rabbi Yonasan says, I sat on the grave of a Ben Sora Umura, he's not saying, I sat on the grave of a 13-year-old child who was executed by the Bezdin. That never happened. So what is he saying? He's saying, I sat on the grave of an 18-year-old child who was stabbed, because that's the life that he chose. And this then is what the Gemara means when it says, Drosh v'kabel sachar. Expound on this passage and you'll receive sachar. What's the sachar? It's not just, so to speak, the sachar of Talmud Torah. There's many other mitzvahs that can yield the same sachar of Talmud Torah, which are applicable. But rather, the sachar is to yield the messages of monitoring these things and being aware of them and alert towards them in order to do what parents can do to ensure that these things do not occur. So these are very interesting comments with regards to Ben Sora Umura, the machlokus, which is a non-machlokus, and to understand how that is. Now, as we move forward to the very next pasuk, in fact, to pasuk Kaf Beis, let us see another of the mitzvos of Parshas Ki Tse. As the pasuk is about to describe, there are certain capital cases who, when they're killed, not only are they killed, but they're also hanged for a certain amount of time. And the reason why is because the death penalty, and this is true in general for all punishments of the Torah, but certainly the death penalty, it has two functions. It's there not, which is always true for these things, it's there not only to dispense justice to the offender, but it's also to act as a deterrent. In other words, if other people see this, as the pasuk says, V'chol Yisrael Yishma'u V'yiroh, let people see, let people hear. The goal is not only to give this person what he deserves for what he did, but that other people should never come to this, should get the message. And moreover, Mefarshim say that's part of the kapara of the person who's killed by the Bezdin, is that he actually serves to prevent other people from repeating his mistake. That's a merit. That's a schus. That's part of his kapara. So the pasuk states, "V'chiyeh v'ish chet mishpat moves v'humas." If a person has a capital case, offense, v'humas, and he's killed, v'salisa zol eitz, and he's hanged from a tree. But this also is a sensitive matter. The pasuk goes on to say, "Lo talin nivlaso ala eitz." He cannot be hanged there overnight. Ki kavartik brenu beyomu, he has to be buried on that day. Ki kilalas elokim talui. Because at the end of the day, a person, even that person, is a tzelem elokim, and it's a bizoyon to the tzelem elokim to be left hanging there overnight. So on the one hand, there needs to be an example made, but we're also sensitive that it shouldn't be at the expense. Sometimes people see someone hanging there, and then that itself desensitizes them to the loss of human life. If we show consideration even to the murderer, hopefully would-be murderers will show consideration to their potential victims. Interestingly, before we move to examine the pasuk at a somewhat closer level, this pasuk, the words in pasuk Kaf Gimel, ki kavartik berenu beyomahu, are actually halachically beyond the context of this particular capital case. It's the source in the Torah for the mitzvah of burying the deceased in general. That's a requirement for all. And when you think about it, there are actually two instructions in this pasuk. Number one, lo salniv lo salin nivlaso ala eitz, not to keep him on the tree overnight. But number two, kikvor tikberenu, to bury him on that day. One could envisage one without the other. You could take him down from the tree, but still not bury him. These are two separate things. And the second one is a mitzvah in general. And moreover, there's a very interesting comment of the Meshech Chochma, and he adduces for us, or enlists for us, a certain approach to Parshanut, which we have mentioned on a number of occasions, which he refers to as Mugbalut, or others would call Mukbalut, that is to say, parallel phrasing within the Pasuk. What does that mean? Let's describe it as helpfully as we can, and then we'll see straight away how he applies it to our Pasuk. We normally understand that psukim move in a straight line. Every phrase in a pasuk relates to the phrase that came before it. That's a linear way of reading. However, sometimes the pasuk may present a phrase and then will not immediately go on to qualify it or clarify it. It may actually present two phrases and then proceed to qualify each of them respectively, which means you can have four phrases in the pasuk, but their relationship is not 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, but rather 1 and 2 are themselves two separate things, and then 3 and 4 qualify 1 and 2 respectively. So the pasuk looks more like a square now than like a straight line. And Meshech Chochma suggests that our psukim are just... Our Pasuk Kaf Gimel is an example of such a thing, because there are, as we mentioned, there are two mitzvos in the beginning of Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Number one, negative, lo salin nivlaso ala eitz, do not leave him there hanging on the tree. Number two, kikavor tikberenu beyom hahu, he has to be buried on that day. And as we mentioned, that's true for any deceased, needs to be buried on that day. And then the Pasuk says ki introduces an explanation. But as we will see, the pasuk will provide to give two explanatory phrases. Why two? Because it's given us two mitzvahs. It then explains them respectively. Therefore, the first key, the first reason given is kilelas Elokim taloi. That's a bizayon. He's a tzelem Elokim. That's suspended there. That reason applies to the first mitzvah in the pasuk. Lo salin nivlaso aleis, not to leave him on the tree. But the second reason, velo sitame esad masacha, do not defile the land, do not bring impurity to the land, is the explanation for the second mitzvah, ki kavar tikberenu, it's not becoming, and perhaps even worse, for the land, for a deceased not to be buried on that day. So we have mitzvah 1, mitzvah 2, reason 1, reason 2. That's called mukbalut. That's called parallel phrasing, parallel explaining. Now, to get back to Pasuk Kaf Beis and to ask a couple of very interesting questions which are raised by the Vilna Gaon. Firstly, v'chiyev ish chet mishpat moves v'humas. If a person has a sin deserving of death and he's put to death, v'salisoso al eitz. Asks the Vilna Gaon, as we know, and we're getting close to, so to speak, the season where we will be discussing all of these things. The season of Tshuva deals with sin. Tshuva is about confronting sin, as opposed to avoiding it or perhaps enshrining it. And as we know, there are a number of words in Lashon HaKodesh for sin. There's different types. Specifically, there is chet, like we say, chatanu, avinu, pashanu. There's three different types. But what is the difference between them? They're not synonyms. I mean, the davening is long enough. We don't need to say everything three times over. But the point is that there are different types of sins. Specifically, and this is from the Gemara in Maseches Yuma and Daf Lamed Vav, chet refers to something done unintentionally, inadvertently. That's why when a person does a sin, certain types of sin unintentionally, they bring a korban chatos. Okay. Avon is deliberate. And Pesha has a certain contentiousness to it, a certain rebelliousness to it, that it responded to the rebellious strength within a person. He thought that he would make a demonstration of that. So those are the three terms: chet, avon, and pesha. Unintentional, yes intentional, and with intent to rebel. So look at the word that the pasuk chose for the type of sin the person did. If he has a chet over which he should be killed, that's a contradiction in terms. Once we appreciate that the specific designation of chet is an unintentional sin, a person is never killed for an unintentional sin. He's not killed by the Beis Din unless he is warned and accepts the warning. You know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he is aware and conscious that he's doing something wrong. So of all the terms for sin, chet would be the worst. Call him avon mishpat maves, call him pesha mishpat maves, or something like that. Why does it use the term chet? It's the least appropriate term because it's the least punishable offense. Secondly, and here's an interesting parshanut question. If you look at the way the pasuk describes it, v'chiye v'ish chet mishpat maves. If a person has a sin, what does it mean to have a sin? That's a very, I would say, euphemistic way of referring to a person who's done something wrong. What's with him? He has a sin. Where did he get it from? He did it. A person is never punished for being in possession of sin. A person only has it. It's not something that is like a rash that you just wake up with in the morning. It's something that a person did. So why does the pasuk use this such a... almost like a non-direct way of, we would call a politically correct way of referring to his situation. He has a sin. Where did he get it from? I don't know. It just happened. He got it from somewhere. He did it. It should have said, V'chiyaseh ish chet mishpat maves. Why does the Torah refer to it in that way? And the Vilna Gaon, and this is really part of the Gaon's general approach to such matters, whereby... And he stated this on many occasions. Every halacha that you find can also be can be ultimately traced back to the psukim if you know how to read them. And there's an important discussion that takes place with regards to these situations. We know there's a concept called tshuva, repentance, and tshuva makes a big difference. But does it make a difference to the Beis Din? An interesting shaila. In our experience, certainly in our Elul and Tishrei experience, whatever, because we're answering only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, if you do tshuva, and if you do tshuva correctly and sincerely, everything gets wiped away. Does the Beis Din also respond in that way, an earthly court? They clearly do not. Because if they did, there would be no such thing as punishment. Because whenever they approach the person, he'd say, I understand, you're coming to punish me. However, I'm duty-bound to inform you, I've since done tshuva, and it's all been sorted out, and therefore, we can all go home. That's not true. The Beis Din, by the nature of what the Beis Din is meant to do, is not allowed to just disband their apparatus because the person says that they did tshuva. Even though he does need to do tshuva. As the Mishnah in Masechet Sanhedrin outlines, the person is led out to his punishment, he's told to do tshuva. For him, he should do tshuva, but the Beis Din can't back away from whatever punishment that they were going to do on the basis of the fact that he's done tshuva. So, says the Vilna Gaon, the Gemara, again, well-known statements in the Gemara, this is in the end of Masechet Yuma, says that tshuva has the power to change sin into something else. It depends what type of tshuva. The lower level of tshuva can, at the very least, as Reish Lakish says, gedola tshuva shezedonos nasu kishgogos. Tshuva is great, this is the basic level of tshuva, that intentional sins can be rendered as unintentional sins. How? Because the person, he removes the intent by his retroactive regret. And that's the chiddush of tshuva, but that's how it works. and therefore by removing the intent from them, they now are rendered acts without intent. That's called shogeg. Zedonos nasu kishkogos. The Gemara has another statement, a parallel statement, that averus can even become mitzvos. That's a very popular idea. And the Gemara says it depends what motivates a person to do tshuva. Fear of punishment or to pursue a relationship with Hashem. If it's fear of punishment, so then that's the lower level. And the intent is sucked out of the sin retroactively. If it's to pursue a relationship with Hashem, then the sin sometimes is even brings the relationship closer. One never embarks on sin with that intention. But that's how a sin can even become a mitzvah. But to come back to the lowest common denominator, we can never presume more than that. What that means, therefore, is by the time a person comes to be punished by the Beis Din, if he's acting as he should, namely having done tshuva, he should no longer be in possession of an intentional sin. Because his tshuva, even the lowest level of tshuva, should have turned an intentional sin into an unintentional sin. And that is why the pasuk refers to this situation as a person who has a chait. We ask two questions. Number one, why do you say he has a chait? Wasn't his sin intentional? And moreover, we asked, why are you talking about what he has? Why not talk more directly about what he did? But this is the point. At the time that he did an intentional sin. Otherwise, he wouldn't be being punished. But having done tshuva, whereas he did an intentional sin, he now has an unintentional sin. His tshuva has left him in possession of a chait. And what's the point of the pasuk? V'humas, he still needs to be killed. Beis Din, it's important for him in terms of his own relationship with Hashem. But the Beis Din still need to kill him. And that is to mete out justice. That's the source in the Torah for this halacha that the tshuva is required, but it doesn't take away the punishment of the Beis Din. So that's the way the Vilna Gaon learns the Chumash. I just mentioned before moving on, one of the most unusual usages of this pasuk, probably ever, was in a hesped that the Arizal gave after the passing of the Ramak Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. A bit of background: Svat in the 1500s, that was where all the Mekubalim were, and Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, he was there before the Arizal. And the Arizal came. And their approaches to Kabbalah are not exactly the same. There's certain differences between them. Now is not the time to elaborate on those things, which is a polite way of saying I don't understand the difference between the two. But in any case, so shortly after the Arizal came to Tzfat, so the Rav Moshe Cordovero passed away, and they were mechabed the Arizal to give the hesped. So the Arizal stood up, and he said, when I bring to mind the Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the great Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the pasuk that I feel sums up the essence of this great person is the pasuk in Parshas Kiseitse, which states, "V'chiye v'ish chet mishpat moves, v'humas v'solisu oso al eitz," which we have translated already. If a person has a sin that makes him liable to death, to be killed, and then he's killed, he's hanged on a tree. This pasuk, as referred to Rav Moshe Cordovero, needs some further explanation. Says the Arizal, the deeper meaning of the pasuk is as follows. We note that the Torah uses the word chet, and chet refers to something unintentional. Actually, the word chet also means to be missing. If something is missing, if you're familiar with that expression, lachti es hamatara, when an arrow is shot, it doesn't reach its target, it's called lachti. Batsheva, when she comes to David HaMelech, and she says that if Adonio, if he's the one who becomes the king, so me and Shlomo, our son Shlomo, we will miss out permanently. Vaya ani ubeni Shlomo chataim kol hayamim. It doesn't mean that they'll be sinning; they're not doing anything. She's saying to David, if you don't do something to vouchsafe the monarchy for him, we will lose out permanently. That's called chataim. Says the Arizal, it's a fact of life. Everyone has their issues. The concept of mishpat maves, a case to depart from the world. Everyone has one, because people make mistakes and people have faults and shortcomings and their weaknesses, etc. which means that if should we ever ask the question, why did a person leave the world, the answer is, in the end of the day, everyone has the reason why they leave the world. And what if you can't find such a reason? What if you happen upon an individual, you cannot imagine that there's any reason that would justify that person leaving the world? How do you explain it? The answer, says their result, is there is an overarching concept of departing from this world as a result of the chait of the Eitz Hadas. When Adam, as the pasuk says, Adam is everyone is born from Adam. When Adam ate from the tree, ki v'yom achalcha mimenu mos tamus, and therefore death was brought into the world. So for most people, you don't need to get to the tree. For most people, it's of their own doing, for a greater or for lesser. But sometimes there's people that there's nothing, and still they leave the world. How can it be? It's because of the Eitz Hadas that death is part of life until further notice. Says the Arizal, that's what the pasuk is saying. Most people have a mishpat mavis. But what if you find a person who's missing a mishpat mavis? He doesn't have one. There's no conceivable grounds that he could have left the world. V'chiyev ish chet mishpat mavis. Chet means this, it's lacking. V'humas, and yet he dies anyway. How do you explain it? To what can you ascribe it? Upon what can you pin it? Says the pasuk v'saliso oso al eitz. You put it on the eitz. You put it on the eitz hadas, and that's just the situation for everyone. Says the Arizal, Rabbi Moshe Cordoverder was a person who had a chet mishpat mavis. He did not have. He was missing a mishpat mavis. He's departed from the world. That's about the eitz hadas, and that's why I quoted this pasuk then. So that's a very interesting. I'm not sure if that hesped has been repeated by anyone else about anyone else. But that was the. This is quoted by the Chida in the Sefer Nachal Kedumim, that famous episode there. Let's move on now. There's many halachic. Of course, we don't get overly into the halachic details, but specifically to see how it comes out from the psukim themselves. And in the beginning of Perek Kaf Beis, we have the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. And this is not the first time Hashavas Aveda features in the Torah. Of course, it's a part of Parshas Mishpatim, but we have it again with new halachas, as is the way of Mishnah Torah. Says the pasuk, Lo tir'eh eshor achicha o esyon nidachim v'salamta mehem. Do not see your brother's your fellow's ox or his sheep wandering around. Don't ignore them. Hashav tishivim nachicha. You've got to give them back. But what if the owner is nowhere near, or you don't know who he is? So bring the lost object into your house. So keep it with you until your brother comes looking for it, and then you'll have it. And then you give it back to him. So on and so forth. Now, what's interesting is, we note, if we go back to the end of Pasuk Aleph here, right, do not see, he's wandering around, don't ignore it. Rather, Hashev Teshiveim La'achicha. Now, we have learned to become rather uncomfortable around these double expressions. Hashev Teshiveim. The convenient English translation for something like this, Hashev Teshiveim, is you shall surely return it. That, of course, is not satisfactory, because the Torah tends to be quite sure of everything that it tells you to do, and doesn't need to say it twice in order for us to know that you shall surely do this. What then is the meaning of Hashev Teshiveim? And again, the Gemara picks up on this, and the Gemara says the double expression of giving it back expands the possibilities of giving it back. Let's ask an interesting shaila. If you have something that belongs to someone else, for example, you borrowed something from someone and the time comes to give it back, do you have to tell them that you gave it back? Or is it enough just to put it in their premises and you're on your way? The halacha is, you have to tell them. It's not enough to say, well, I gave it back. Until he knows that I've given it back, I have not fulfilled my obligations vis-a-vis him as a borrower, and so on and so forth. The rule is, if you're returning something to someone that you took with their permission, you've got to let them know. Otherwise, because if something happens, it's still your fault. The exception is Hashavas Aveda. When it comes to Hashavas Aveda, if you know where the person lives, you can bring it back to their house and you do not need to tell them. And that expanded option for giving it back even without telling them is what is learned from the pasuk Hashev Tishivim. The ribui, the plurality, gives you more than one option. You don't need to tell them. Okay, that's good to know. It's interesting, however, that in the end of pasuk Beis, which also tells you to give it back, it just has the single expression, Vahashevo solo. And our question is, therefore, once the Torah has told us that when it comes to returning lost property, Hashev Tishivim, it uses the double expression, telling you, even without them knowing, why in the next pasuk does it revert to the single expression, which implies that they do need to know? Why did we go back from double to single? Now, I think the Balabatish answer to this question is because the second pasuk actually describes the person coming to you to collect it. That's the point. You don't know who he is, so you keep it until the person comes. So if a person comes, and as we know, this is the famous halachas, he's got to identify it, he has to give simanim, etc., to prove that it's his. So he's turning up to take it from you. So there is no concept of returning it to him without him knowing. He's come for it. I think that's the Balabatish answer to the usage of the single term there. The Meshech Chochmah has another, as always, has another angle here. If we ask the question, why is it that generally in returning lost property, the person doesn't need to be told, and you can just take it back, and you fulfilled your obligation? Why is it so? So I think, again, on a simple level, we'd say, well, the Torah is just giving the finder a dispensation, as if to say, he didn't ask for this, he's doing a mitzvah, he's doing a good deed, and therefore the Torah almost comes to meet him, so to speak, as if to say, you did the right thing, you've given it to him, so he gets a hanacha. You have to wait to tell him, etc. You've done enough, and good for you. But the Meshech Chochmah says there's more to it than that. There's another reason why you don't need to tell him, and that is because he's looking out for it. He's expecting someone to give it to him. Isn't that so? When a person loses something, as long as they haven't been misyayish, what's called, as long as they haven't given up. So what does it mean not to give up? You haven't given up hope means you still hope. That means that when you look out your window, or however many times it is a day, you think, has someone found it? Has someone, that's what hope is. It's expectation, because he's expecting and hoping that someone will give it back, so then that's his part of it. You can assume that very soon after you put it back in his premises, he'll notice it, because he's looking out for it. Very interesting approach to this. That's why you don't have to tell him. You can assume he's got eyes on the front of his house. Okay. So this brings us to Pasuk Beis. Pasuk Beis, which contains the expression Vahashevo solo, again yields for us a very interesting halacha. Who needs to bear the expenses of the lost article? By which we mean, let's say it's an animal that needs to be fed. Who needs to pay for its food? The one who finds the object does not then need to pay for its upkeep from his own pocket. He is fully entitled to keep a cheshbon and say, you know, the animal is worth, however it is, $300, but it was $10 a day. And it's been 3 days, so I'll give it back to you, but you owe me $30. And that's completely fair. Now, if that's true, if it's really the owner of the object, the one who lost it, who needs to bear the expenses, so what would happen if the expenses are threatening to actually exceed the value of the item itself? As if to say, if it's for a few days and it's $10 a day, that may well be. But what if it's for a few weeks? The animal's only worth $300 and you're not really entitled to necessarily work it. So if you keep this for 5, 6, 7 weeks, so by the time you finally give it back to the owner, you present him with two things. Number one, an animal worth $300. Number two, a bill for $400. So what type of toiva is that? And that's why the halacha is, interestingly, at a certain point, and of course all these things are quantified, at a certain point, what is more recommended is you should sell the animal, convert it into money, freeze it, and give him back the money. He'll thank you for it. It's better, because at least you don't need to feed money. And that's what Bahashevo Solo means. Think about how you can give it back to him in the most helpful way, which may involve sometimes selling it. It may be his prized cow, but he'd prefer to be in the black than in the red. Says the Meshech Chochmah, because the word Vashevo Solo tells you that sometimes you convert it into something else, now you understand why if you do that, but then you want to give him back the money, for example, you'd have to tell him. Why? Because he didn't lose money. He lost an animal. Which means if the dispensation for not having to tell him that you gave it back is because we rely on him expecting to see it, he's looking out for it. He's looking out for what he lost, not for something else. He's looking out for a cow to be let in. He's not looking out for money to be left somewhere, and that could easily go unnoticed. And that is why, says Meshech Chochmah, if we're alert to the message of Vahashev Osele, which is you convert it into something else, now you know why it only used a single expression. Because the double expression says you don't need to tell him, but if you convert it into something else, you do need to tell him, because he's not looking out for it. You've got to let him know. So what's fascinating about this, and again, it's in the world of Parshanut and Halacha, they all come together, but I would say what's quite classic about this is Meshech Chochmah, he, as he so often does, takes us. You start in the Pasuk, and there's certain things that you need to go to the Gemara to explain. Why the double expression? What's Vashev Oselo? But very often, as we move from the Pasuk to the Gemara, we never go back to the Pasuk. It's a one-way trip. Because I've learned the Pasuk and understood it, and now I move on to the Gemara. And the Meshech Chochmah says, if you've gone from the Pasuk to the Gemara, go back to the Pasuk. Because now that you know what you know, there are certain things about the Pasuk which you can then further explain. As here he demonstrates. So that's a word about Hashavas Aveda from the Meshech Chochmah. Our final discussion for this evening relates to, again, one of the well-known halachas of the Parsha, Ammon and Moab. And that is in Perek Kaf Gimel Pasuk Dalet. Ammon Umov. So this is the beginning of Perek Kaf Gimel. It's about all of those who cannot enter into the Jewish people. But when we say that, we mean that they cannot marry into the Jewish people. Ammon Umov, they can convert if they want, but they need to marry among themselves or perhaps others, but not amongst the Jewish people mainstream. Lo yavo Ammoni Umoavi b'kal Hashem. Gamdor Asiri lo yavo lem b'kal Hashem. They cannot enter into the congregation again through marriage. They can convert, but not to marry in, so to speak. There is a well-known halacha that relates to this. Of course, around Shavuot's time, we talk about it a lot, that it only applies to the males from Ammon and Moab, not the females. As the Gemara describes it in Yevamos and Daf Ayin Zayin, Ammoni velo Ammonis, Moavi velo Moavis. Why? Well, there's many explanations given, but a fascinating explanation is found in the Balaturim on this pasuk. The Balaturim says that the females, or shall we say the female element within Ammon and Moab, is on a higher level than the male element. How so? Because the male progenitor was Lot. The female progenitors were his daughters. That's back to that whole Parsha in Parshas Vayera. They escaped from Sodom, and they think that this is it. It's just the three of them. They had a slightly restricted vision of how big the world is, or they didn't know what was happening, but they thought that's it. So for the sake of the propagation of human beings, so they made their decision, right, to bear children from their father, and the Gemara says it was L'shem Shamayim. Lot, on the other hand, had no such altruistic thoughts. It was not L'shem Shamayim. And therefore, says the Balaturim, since the male input to what is effectively an Aveira, because they're his daughters, but one could say it's an Aveira Lishma, because they did it for altruistic reasons. And therefore, the female aspect is on a much higher level than the male aspect. And that's why the males are barred, even though the Pasuk gives other reasons, but at a root level, that's where this distinction comes from. Interestingly, as we move from Halacha to Halacha Lemaisa, it's important to note, worthwhile noting, that as the Rambam says, and it's based on the Gemara, this prohibition is all but inapplicable nowadays for a very simple reason. No one knows who Amon and Moab are, and more to the point, how do you know anyone is? Where do they come from? You know where Amon is, you know where Moab is, but the point is all of those nations were mixed up by Sennacherib. And Sennacherib invaded the region, and Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, in order to prevent any type of uprising, he relocated all populations so that they would be unfamiliar with their surroundings, etc., to keep them disorientated and to keep them quiet. Ala Sennacherib ubilbel es ha'umos. And therefore, ironically, if a person comes from the country of Ammon, it's practically guaranteed that he is not Ammoni. He's somewhere else, but then the rove are not Ammoni. Just follow the rove. Interestingly, this very question was discussed on a famous day. The Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Kaf Ches describes the deposition of Rabbi Gamliel as the Nasi. That's the whole situation with Rabbi Yeshua. He dealt in a very harsh way with Rabbi Yeshua. And they deposed him, which is itself a big chiddush. I mean, the rabbis got together and they said, he can't be the Nasi anymore. We're not familiar that you could do that to a Nasi. But they did. And that's when they approached Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Harayana kibin shivim shana. And important to get a good sense of Rabbi Gamliel's intentions here. And this is discussed by Rabbi Yosef Leib Bloch in the Shiurei Das. It's not correct to say that he's an authoritarian and using power, etc. The Sanhedrin is, by this stage, the only surviving institution of Judaism. There is no Beis HaMikdash. It has recently been destroyed. This is the generation where they're post-Churban. For many people, they weren't sure that there's such a thing as Judaism anymore. They are so used to Beis HaMikdash at the center, everything's been destroyed, you have a Sanhedrin, but what is that? And what we take for granted, that even in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, but you have Torah in the middle, that was something that needed to be established. And therefore, Rabbi Gamliel was extremely insistent that the authority and those sensitive times of the Nasi and the Sanhedrin should not be challenged. His colleagues felt he overdid it, but that's where it came from. And how do we know? Says it tells a Rav, the way we can get a sense of Rabbi Gamliel's intentions here is to see what he did when he was deposed. Because if his motivations were what we would call political or shalom lishma or whatever you want to call it, what happens when a person is deposed from a position in a certain institution? Within 3 days, there's another institution down the road that starts. And the full expectation would be that Rabbi Gamliel would be mortified and would be licking his wounds and never go back and open the Beis HaMedrash for the real scholars. In the event, says the Gemara, it's unbelievable. Va'af Rabbi Gamliel lo mana atzma mi Beis HaMedrash afilu sha achas. He did not refrain from the Beis HaMedrash even for 1 hour. Within an hour of being deposed, he was there learning with the very same colleagues that deposed him. Why? Because he's not the Nasi anymore. So it's not his job anymore. When he had the job, he did it as best he could, as he saw fit. If he was outvoted, however that worked, so he's not the Nasi anymore. So what is he? He's a Jew. So he learns together with everyone else. And moreover, he got involved in the very first machlokas that came up on that day. Someone approached. He was, I think his name was, I can't remember. The Gemara says Yeshua, maybe Ben-Ger. Ammoni, and he says, can I marry to the Jewish people? And Rabbi Yeshua is there. And this is the Rabbi Yeshua that Rabbi Gamliel had taken such harsh measures against. And Rabbi Yeshua says, it's mutter, of course, it's mutter. And Rabbi Gamliel gets involved straight away. He doesn't stay in the corner saying, well, until someone invites me, I'm not going to deign to comment again. He doesn't wait for an invitation. Well, he's one of the scholars now. How can you say that? What do you mean? Lo yav amoni. And Rabbi Yeshua says, but Sennacherib came. He mixed everyone up. But Rabbi Gamliel countered that and says, but isn't there a prophecy that says that Hashem will return Ammon? Maybe that's happened already. And therefore, he's back Ammon again. Rabbi Yeshua said, yeah, Hashem said he'd return the Jewish people also. These things don't happen so quickly. But so it's a very interesting, and Mefarshim discussed this, in a sense, the significance of why the most hotly contested discussion on that historic day when Rabbi Gamliel was deposed was about this ger. He comes from Ammon. What was he waiting for? Maybe no one let him in before. And all of a sudden he becomes the talk of the whole Beis HaMedrash. Rabbi Gamliel is there together with with everyone else. In any event, at the Pasuk provides the reason for this permanent ban on Ammon and Moab. And actually gives two reasons. Firstly, Al-Duvar Ashilokidmu Eschem Balechem Uvamayim Baderech Beseischem in Mitzrayim. They didn't come to meet you with food and drink when you came out from Mitzrayim. And secondly, Vasher Socher Alechas Bilam Min Be'or Mipusor Aram Naharam Nekalech. And moreover, they hired Bilam to curse you. They or he, that's already Moab, that's not Ammon. Okay. Well, there's a very interesting comment of the Dubna Magid here. We understand commonly that the Torah is providing two strikes against Ammon / Moab. They didn't come to meet you, and they should, by the way, as the Ramban says, Ammon and Moab owe their existence to the ancestors of the Jewish people, because it's in the Schus of Avram that Lot was saved. They all come from Lot. And amazingly, as far as Ramban is concerned, that's what it means to be grateful. It should filter down, even generations later, sort of thing. Everyone else, the Jewish people are coming out. You should have gone to meet them. That you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for where they come from. So we have these two reasons. But in fact, says the Dubna Magid, the Ikar reason is that they did not come to meet you with food and drink. You're just coming out. That's something they certainly should have done. What's cursing Bilam? What's that got to do with that? That's much, much later. How does that relate to anything here? The point is, says Dubna Magid, sometimes when a person is indicted, there is a potential response. And as long as that response goes unanswered, so then difficult to indict. You say they didn't come out with food and drink. We don't know what their resources are. We don't know what they're able to come up with. Says the Dubna Magid, but when they spend a fortune to hire Bilam to curse you, so you know there's money there, and you know that when the cause is deserving, so the funds are forthcoming, and in a sense, therefore, it seals a potential counter argument, as if to say, you know, food and drink, it's not the budget is not what it used to be, and there's a bit of a deficit, and we're a change of management, v'chule v'chule. No, there's plenty of money when you need it. This was just cause. But the truth is, we have not done full justice to this pasuk here. And Rashi even comments, which means that it raises a flag even on Derech HaPshat. Rashi says on pasuk Hey, on the very first words, Al Devar. I think we're so used to the pasuk we let it go without comment. Rashi never gets used to anything. And therefore, if there's a comment to be made, he'll make it. We've almost finished the Chumash. So far, so good. Says Rashi, until it's the final pasuk, keep your eyes and ears open. Al devar, says Rashi, al ha'etza sheyatzu eschem lachtiachem. On the devar, on the advice that they conspired against you to make you sin. This, of course, is a reference to Baal Peor, which was in a sense worse than anything else, and it caused more damage than anything else. How does this come from the word al-devar? We know that the word devar, we translate the word devar as a matter, but devar is expounded from the word dibur, matter of speech. And moreover, when you think about it, the word devar is completely redundant. Because what does it mean? It means on the matter. What does a matter mean? If you're about to say what the matter is, you don't need to say that there's a matter here. You just say. Which means the pasuk should have said, Al asher lo kidmu eschem, but on account of the fact they didn't come to meet with bread and water. What's al devar? It's an unnecessary way of presenting it. Just get to what the matter is. You don't need to tell me there's a matter. And that's why, because the word devar is redundant, it's a separate thing. It's the dibur. It's the advice that Bilam gave with regards to Benos Moav. And moreover, from a certain point of view, this becomes the dominant reason. Why do we say this? Because Rashi and Pasuk Tes says, if you look at the later nations that are also barred from marrying into the Jewish people, Mitzri, Edomi, right, which are mentioned in Pasuk Tes, right, those say Edomi, those say Mitzri, Banim Ashe Vadulem Dor Shlishi Avolem Mikal Hashem. They can become naturalized, so to speak, after three generations, they can marry into the Jewish people. So this is very interesting. For Ammon and Moab, the ban against them marrying to the Jewish people is permanent. For Mitzrayim and Edom, it is temporary. Why? What do we have? Why Mitzrayim and Edom banned at all? Because they tried to kill us. Each one in their own way. And what does that give them? Three generations banned. Ammon and Moab, they made us sin. What's the result? Permanent. And Rashi quotes the Sifrei, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Halamadata, you learn from here, Shamachti la'odam kashila minahargo. To cause a person to sin is worse than killing him. Shahargo hargo ba'olam hazeh, you kill a person, you take him out of this world. Vamachtiya motziya minaolam hazeh u minaolam haba. You put a person on a wrong track, that's eternal damage. Lefichach, Edom shekadam becherub, Edom came out to us with swords. And they're letting off to three generations. Mitzrayim, what did Mitzrayim not do to the Jewish people? After three generations, they're in. Ve'elu shechdiyam, but these two, Ammon and Moab, and they're out permanently. So it's fascinating that in a sense you have three reasons now for Ammon and Moab, and the most dominant is the least pronounced. And you could almost miss it. But Rashi says, don't miss it. But now the question is, so if it's so dominant, why is it not more explicit? As if to say, Al-Pa'or, spell it out. And we'll all be, why leave it? Why leave it in a remez? Says the Be'er Yitzchak. Because the Jewish people were not blameless. It's a much more complex situation, the whole situation in Al-Pa'or. The daughters of Moab couldn't have sinned by themselves. They enticed the Jewish people, and for that they are eternally at fault, but the Jewish people were enticed. There's a time and a place for everything. There is a time to chastise the Jewish people. But when you talk about what their enemies did to them, that's not a time to talk about with the Jewish people. The Jewish people, there's many ways to say this, and the Be'er Yitzchak says it in a slightly different way. The Jewish people should not be blaming themselves at the time when it comes to talk about the blame of those who have perpetrated things against them, even though in the fullness of the equation there is room for some fault on the part of the Jewish people. But when the time comes to discuss what their enemies deserve, that's not the time to focus on what the Jewish people themselves did wrong. And therefore, or as the Be'er Yitzchak himself says in a much more straightforward way, Kvodam Shel Yisrael, it's the honor of the Jewish people. You're here talking about their enemies. That's not the time to start dragging up all the things the Jewish people did wrong. And therefore, as much as it's the most significant, if you're alert, you'll see it. But it's not pushed out because Moshe is addressing the Jewish people, and out of respect for the Jewish people, it's stated in the way that it is. And those are the comments of Mefarshi Rashi. On occasion, we'll leave it over there for this evening.